Thank you very much. We are here to bring you the story behind the music you love and to introduce you to the men who make that music at Orchestra Hall. You'll also get to hear an informal and easy-to-understand discussion of music and its interesting personalities. And what's more, you, listening right now, have an opportunity to win two main floor tickets for a concert by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra at Orchestra Hall. And today, let's turn to the pages of your symphony scrapbook that tell about the soprano of the brass choir, the trumpet. And we have with us Mr. Vincent Chickowitz, member of the trumpet section of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Mr. Chickowitz, I'm sure our listeners would like to have you identify the selection that you played at the beginning of this program and perhaps play some more from that symphonic composition.
That was from the Sibelius Second Symphony, the very last movement.
Since this is the first time we've had the pleasure of having you on this program, since you've just joined forces with us in the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, Mr. Chickowitz, I think our listeners might be interested in learning something about your background, your early training in music, something about any previous orchestral experience you have, so they come to know you as a person as well as a member of the orchestra.
Well, my training's been entirely in the city of Chicago. I have studied with various teachers in this city, Mr. Reynold Schilke and Mr. Sidney Baker, who was a one-time former first trumpet of our orchestra, and Mr. Adolph Herseth. And I had attended Civic Orchestra for three seasons. Previous to that, I had spent one season in the Houston Symphony and had spent six summers out at Grand Park in Chicago.
That's interesting to me because, of course, as you well know, for a long time, until perhaps 20 or 30 years ago, it was considered the thing for a symphonic organization in this country to go to, wasn't it Germany and Austria for their brass players?
Yes.
We never thought
right.
of training our own, and it's mighty nice to have a local boy who makes good. I ran across a little, not a poem, just a rhyme about your instrument the other day. Goes this way. It tingles spines, it shivers walls, it's used for sports and battle calls. But of course, we know from the fact that you're on this program and your opening selection was played from Sibelius that it is a very important instrument in the symphonic combination. Would you consider it a solo instrument?
Yes, very definitely. Many times, of course, it's used merely to bolster sonority in the orchestra. For instance, in playing the big tuties in many of our symphonic compositions, but very often it is used as a solo instrument and in very flexible fashion.
When you say flexible, you mean it's not always playing loud?
Well, that's it. It's not always loud. It's not always broad and sustained. It might be very flippant, you might say, in effect. I think as an illustration we have the excerpt from the Peter and Wolf, which might show that.
Could we have that now? I'm interested in the trumpet for many reasons, one of which is that it's a very old instrument. Of course, it goes back to very, very old old times, to biblical times, I imagine, almost even prehistoric times, and it certainly has changed its shape dozens of times. Some of the orchestral instruments are about the same today as they were when they were first developed, but the trumpet has changed from a straight tubing, hasn't it, to curved tubing and then doubled back on itself? And...
Well, in reality, in relationship to its antiquity, you might say that it really hasn't evolved too greatly, because it did begin originally as a straight tube, and to a certain extent it still exists in that form. Of course, we have added valves and crooks to it in order to enable us to play the chromatic scale, which, of course, the natural trumpet would be unable to do.
Well, now, what is the range of the trumpet?
Oh, it's approximately 2.5 octaves.
2.5 octaves. Well, how can you play all those notes, a listener might ask, or a viewer, let's say, might ask, with just 3 valves?
Well, I think perhaps better than a verbal description might be a performance of such. We have 3 valves, which are, in each turn, are connected to 3 different sets of tubing. And in overblowing these particular sets, we achieve a certain amount of what we call a harmonic series, anyway. And by overblowing each one of these, we enable ourselves to complete the chromatic scale.
No, would it be an unfair question to say, now, what do you mean by overblowing?
Well, it's rather
a difficult question to
illustrate by words, but it's by pressure of the embouchure against the mouthpiece plus the breath.
Well, in other words, playing a trumpet consists of something more than putting it at your lips, blowing air into the tube, and pressing down a valve.
Very definitely.
Well, now, when you press down a valve, does it have the same effect on the tubing as when a violinist presses his finger on a string and thereby shortens the string and thereby increases the pitch? In other words, the shorter the string, the higher the pitch.
Yes, you might make that comparison. I'd like to show you an example. I'll play this next passage, which will not involve a change of any valve. Now, you see, I did not move my fingers for that. Now, by depressing a different set of valves, I also add other notes of like series, in which makes a complete chromatic scale.
And so by those combinations, you get your 2.5 octaves of range. Now, you use the word embouchure, which, of course, is a well-known word to all brass players. Would you just explain for listeners what that means?
Well, it's a French word, literally meaning mouth. But to us, it connotates the use of our lip muscles in combination with the breath and the tongue, which enable us to change the various pitches.
Well, again, I'll be a very, very naive listener and say, what do you mean by the use of the lip muscles? Is it a case of pushing air into the instrument in a certain way?
Yes, that is part of the technique. But, of course, the changing of the muscular tension in the face would affect the changes also, you see.
Now, then there's a third thing you mentioned, and that's tonguing, which I think is a fascinating idea also in connection with brass players.
Well, it's merely a dividing. You might say it's a dividing technique. In order to create length, we have to use our tongue to start the air, I should say.
And you have what would you call just simple tonguing? You, of course, I know you have double tonguing, you have triple tonguing.
Just the straight use of the syllable T.
And what would illustrate double tonguing?
Well, we use the inarticulate syllable, you might say, of K in the back of the mouth, which is really not tongue, but coughed, you might say, into the instrument.
And triple?
And triple tongue would be the alternation of 2 T's with 1 K.
Well, it sounds complicated, but let's... could we have an illustration of...
Well, first, I'd like to do the double tonguing. Very short example from the Stravinsky Petrushka Suite, but it illustrates, I think, quite well the double tonguing on the trumpet.
And well, there's one other thing I should have mentioned in connection with the technique of playing the trumpet, and that's the mutes, because I notice you have a couple of mutes here, and that's another method by which you can change, tone, changing
yes.
the quality.
The tone quality. The mutes are straight. A straight mute, which we use most often, is, of course, of ancient origin, being merely a pear-shaped device stuffed into the bell. But during the jazz era, several other mutes were developed, and at times we find ourselves employing these various mutes for certain effects in symphonic repertoire.
Could we have an illustration of that?
Certainly. These will be from the Gershwin Rhapsody in Blue.
Is Gershwin a popular composer among trumpet players?
Well, I don't think you could define it that easily. Of course, illustrates the straight mute with the use of the flutter tongue, which, of course, we didn't get a chance to go into detail here.
Well, now, what's the second type of mute?
This is often called the wah-wah mute, but it really is officially a harmon mute. This is also from the Rhapsody in Blue.
Well, thanks ever so much, Mr. Chickowitz, for this interesting demonstration of a very interesting orchestral instrument. And now we're happy to send a pair of tickets for a concert by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra to Dr. Jacob Singer, Rabbi of Temple Mizpah of Chicago, for his interesting letter in the anecdote, which we are now adding to our scrapbook. He says that the late conductor Albert Stursel of the Chautauqua Institute of in New York State told us that he was often asked whether the conductor should use the score or direct without a score, a question which, of course, many symphony goers ask. And he always replied, the important thing is that he should know the score. And he cited this story as an illustration. He said there was a conductor who did not know his score and was always watching the players for their cues. For example, when the violins would begin, he would point to them confidently and wave his arms very gracefully. But, of course, it didn't take long for the players to discover this fraud, so they decided to fool him. At one concert, they were playing the Tannhäuser Overture, and the trumpet players, before the Pilgrim Chorus, raised their instruments 4 measures ahead of time, so the naive conductor pointed to them, but the players shook their heads and said, "Not yet." And thanks very much to Dr. Singer for his interesting anecdote, which we are putting today in our scrapbook.